Hey friends, welcome back to the Collectivist Conversation, where we're having conversations at the intersection of faith and life. Today's got to be one of my favorite episodes. If you know me, you know I love music. I'm a music nerd. So this conversation with Dr. Leah Payne on her new book, God Gave Rock and Roll to You, A History of Contemporary Christian Music, was like my sweet spot. I loved it. She's great. So much insight. It's an academic work about Christian music and contemporary Christian music in particular. So you guys are going to love this conversation. So let's jump right into it right now. Hey friends, welcome back to the Collectivist Conversations podcast, where we're having conversations at the intersection of faith and life. Today we have Dr. Leah Payne, who's a professor of American Religious History at the Portland Seminary, and she's also most recently authored God Gave Rock and Roll to You, A History of Contemporary Christian Music, and it's an academic rock and roll book, which seems crazy to even talk about, but we're going to talk about it. So you mentioned something, I think I saw it on your Instagram or Facebook. You threw up the 1991 Cornerstone either brochure or something. I got to ask, did you attend Cornerstone? Were you there? Do I owe you an apology for a mosh pit bump?
No. That's, I have never been to any Christian music festival ever. So not Cornerstone, which I know for those of, I'm guessing for your podcast listeners, they don't need to be reminded of this, but that is sort of like the taste-making festival for a lot of people who are into kind of more edgier Christian music. And so I wish I would have gone. I feel like I almost feel like I have gone because I've heard so much about it. But were you there at that Cornerstone festival?
I gotta do my math. Maybe 91. So I gotta tell the story. So I grew up, I'm Pentecostal, grown up Church of God, right? My grandfather's a Church of God pastor. In high school, my mom gave me the option of going to whatever church I found a youth group. And so it was super cool of her. So I ended up at this very Willow Creek style church in Northern Illinois. And was very contemporary. So as a 14-year-old, it was super cool. So instead of youth camp, we would traverse in the summer to Cornerstone Festival. Like it was what we did. So take a kid that grew up on Redback hymnals and throw him into Woodstock. That's essentially what it is. And I was like blown away by it.
What do you remember who you first saw, like, and what your experience was with that?
So it had to be 90, 91, probably 91. So it was Newsboys when the drum set would spin. It was DC Talk right before Free at Last released. So it had to be 91. Yeah.
Wow.
So I think the opening night, the first thing I remember is opening night, Glenn Kaiser would do a blues show on a side stage. And so it's like 1 a.m. and I'm at this like blues, Christian blues festival concert at 1 a.m. in the middle of nowhere, Illinois.
Wow.
And that was my introduction into it, like hardcore. So
that's really amazing. I mean, So did you go back every year?
Well, yeah. The next 3 years I attended. Yeah. And it's a weird experience and beautiful all at the same point.
How old were you? Because, okay, so I looked it up and it looks like it was 1990 when DC Talk played Cornerstone.
So, it'd have been the summer after my freshman year. So I'm either 14 or 15 the first time I went.
Okay.
Tent camping, whole bit. Showering in a semi-trailer. It was wild.
Yeah, that one was kind of the more... So I write about in the book, a lot of Christian music festivals happened at sites where there were camp revival meetings back in the day. And, so if you said you grew up with Church of God Cleveland grandparents, then this is exactly like that there are multiple generations of people who are essentially doing revival meetings with rock and roll, but Cornerstone always had kind of a different reputation for that. A lot of it had to do with the organization that sponsored it and like the Japuza crew. So, did you go to any other, or was just Cornerstone kind of like,
so Cornerstone was just it, I think, because I think prior to 1990, they were in meeting at the Lake County Fairgrounds in Northern Illinois, which is where I was living. So I think when they moved, we kind of just followed them. Now, you're the historian, so I'm going to put a name out you should know. I'm a 14-year-old kid going to this very attractional, seeker-sensitive type church as a Pentecostal. And sure. most of the worship was kind of acoustic, kumbaya type stuff. But every once in a while, there'd be an electric guitarist on stage with long blonde hair. And I'm going, who is this guy? And I don't know anything about Christian rock and roll, right? And somebody finally comes to me and goes, oh, that's Rex Carroll. He goes to our church from White Cross.
Really?
So like every like eighth Sunday when they weren't touring the world, Rex Carroll's on stage playing guitar. And I have no idea who he is. I'm like, this guy's just amazing. Who's this? No clue.
Wow. That's fascinating. That's fascinating. And did you stay at that church for a long time?
All the way through high school.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So that was a really formative experience for you.
It was. Yeah. Again, I'm supposed to be interviewing you, but you're doing such a good asking me questions. it shaped this capacity to hold my Pentecostal growing up in tradition, which is what I came back to later on. And this capacity to see church differently than the 25 people that would attend church and sing hymnals and that kind of stuff. So it put these things in tension that I learned to hold as I got older.
That's really neat. Wow. Yeah. Wow. And you said you're a church planter, so yeah. You've planted a church. Was it in connection with that congregation?
No, I'm Assemblies of God now, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But. Well, that's not like a huge leap.
No, it's adjacent, yeah.
Yeah.
So I got to ask, though, what leads someone to write an academic book on the history of contemporary Christian music? Like, what sparked that?
Sure. I was trained in Nashville, Tennessee, to be a scholar, and I grew up in the Foursquare Church, which is sort of like the much younger little sister of the Assemblies of God. Much smaller little sister. And it was born on the West Coast. Yes. And so I grew up in a congregation that was very, very heavily influenced by West Coast charisma. So my parents became they joined the charismatic movement as a part of the Jesus movement on the West Coast in the Bay Area in California in the 1970s. So I was deeply, deeply shaped by the music of people like Larry Norman and Second Chapter of Acts and Keith Green. And I still go back and listen to that music and really enjoy it. It's the music of my childhood. And then the music of 1990s praise and worship stuff. So for people who are listening who know anything about the history of praise and worship music, a lot of the more popular forms were created on the West Coast among those same communities that had birthed the Jesus movement. So Vineyard music, and eventually, you know, it's a transnational musical conversation. So Hillsong and stuff like that. So I just grew up in that world. That was just my church world. And then I married an aspiring contemporary Christian music artist, and we moved to Nashville, Tennessee.
And the home of Christian music.
The center of contemporary Christian music at that time. And I started working in a coffee shop because I had a humanities degree, and so that's just
was a dream. Which coffee shop was it? Was it the one downtown there between Belmont and Vandy where kind of CCM launched? What's that called?
No. Okay. That would have been like the Koinonia Coffee House.
Yeah, yeah.
No. This was in the early 2000s. So this is just a Starbucks. And at that time, Starbucks was pretty new in Nashville. I do remember that because I'm from the Pacific Northwest, and so coffee culture is just everywhere here. And it was funny because I was realizing that people didn't know how to pronounce. At that time, nobody knew how to pronounce a caramel macchiato when they were like in the drive-thru, you know? So I remember it was new in Tennessee. But a couple of my favorite customers were two people named Charlie Peacock and Andy Ashworth, and they together curated this community called the Art House Community. And Charlie has a career that is much larger than contemporary Christian music, but he's also a really, really important and well-known producer and artist in that world. And I used to just talk with them. They're from the West Coast. They're from Yuba City, California, and I was homesick at the time. And I would talk with them about anything, you know, it's just like how you make conversation with a barista. And then one day Charlie offered me a job to be his assistant at his studio. And I didn't really know that much about who he was at the time. I learned. So I worked in that business for several years and then eventually went to graduate school, became a historian. And the world of contemporary Christian music, I'm sure you already know this, it's a really polarizing universe. Now, there are some people who think it's the most wonderful thing, that it is like the gospel with music or music with gospel. Right. There are some people who think it is very bad art and shouldn't exist. Some people think that it is a tool of a certain like form of religious oppression. Some people see it as the hope of the church. You know, like people have strong feelings about it one way or another. But it was often seen as a peripheral part of people's spiritual formation and Christian identity. And sometimes, you know, I think that's because people would joke about it being of poor quality or being kind of uncool. But I knew it to be something that was deeply formative in people's lives. And in some cases, the most important like Christian formation tool in their lives.
Right.
So I decided to use the tools that I had learned as a historian. I went to Vanderbilt in Nashville. And then so I was trained to look at American religious history. And I just thought to myself, well, what could we learn if we look at this one industry, see how it formed, how it developed over time, and then see, you know, what could you learn about this kind of amorphous group that usually goes by the term evangelical? Like, who are those people and what can we learn from them if we look at the music of evangelicalism? So that's what I did. And it was a several year project. It covers over 100 years of history. There are definitely Church of God Cleveland people and Assemblies of God people who make appearances in the book. And I just had so much fun doing it. Sure. And I hope other people do have a good time reading it as well.
Yeah. Now you trace it back to what you're my roots would be, which would be the beginning of Pentecostalism and Azusa Street, especially. How did that early sort of spirit movement, spirit-filled movement that was birthed in California and other places like Topeka, Kansas, kind of give birth to what we now know as CCM? How did those two things linked?
Yeah, I actually start before that. I start in the late 19th century. It's, you know, it's hard to know where to start a book about church music because, I mean, on the one hand, you would have to start with the New Testament, mm-hmm. you know, because Christians have been always, you know, music, hymns and spiritual songs have been a huge part of Christian worship from the get-go. So I started with the moment when the people who would go on to constitute contemporary Christian music were able to put their songs out into the world. So I start in the late 19th century because prior to that, in the United States, the only people who really had access to getting their music out there were elite institutions in publishing hub cities like New York and Philadelphia. So you have, there were like, you know, centuries of musical traditions being developed all around the country. But for a long time, it was just way too expensive to print and distribute that music. So the hymnals that existed prior to that were really produced by a pretty small group of people. And it expressed their theological visions. Like mm-hmm. a hymnal is really a canon, you know, it's it's a selection of songs where we decide this is a representation of the Christian faith through song as we know it. So in the late 19th century, though, there had been some print publishing innovations that all of a sudden made it a lot less expensive to buy a printing press and to distribute printed materials. So the book actually starts with people who were founding figures in a movement known as the Pentecostal Church of the Nazarene. They didn't do Pentecostal practices as we know them, but they were a holiness movement. Mm-hmm. There is a couple of people named John T. and Eva Green Benson who went to an apocalyptic hellfire and brimstone sermon in an abandoned lot in Nashville, Tennessee, a tent revival meeting.
Yeah.
They were just like overcome by what they experienced, and they responded by creating a publishing business. And if you know anything about Nashville, and if you live in Cleveland, you probably know this, is that a lot of people think that music is the primary industry, but print publishing is huge mm-hmm. in Nashville, Tennessee. Yeah. It's long, long history there. So they started a little publishing business, and they did a lot of things. They did pamphlets. They did kind of end times literature and newsletters and stuff like that, that were expressing this kind of late 19th century holiness movement idea. But then they also did hymnals and songbooks, and the songbooks were the things that really sold well. And so through this publishing company, which eventually became known as the Benson Company, which eventually became Benson Records, mm-hmm. which was one of the most influential contemporary Christian music record labels. The songs of Southern white holiness people, as well as Baptists who use their hymnals and publish their own, and Pentecostals. And it's a really interesting group of people who decide they're going to cooperate with each other through music. Because at that time, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, those three groups had huge theological differences with each other. Especially Holiness and Baptists had a very hard time with Pentecostals because, in part, of the fact that they had, you know, you brought up Azusa Street on the West Coast. There was this interracial revival meeting, which in the segregated South was just like almost hard to even comprehend for many Southern white holiness and Baptist revivalists. But they also had, you know, conflicts over the practice of speaking in tongues and divine healing and prophecy. So these groups were willing to work together at an early, like in the early 20th century, because they could agree on the types of theologies that were coming out of the music that they were producing mm-hmm. together. And so that's where the book starts. It starts with these three groups, because this is a fascinating thing to me, is that the overwhelming majority of people who produced music that charted in the contemporary Christian music like scene, either on Billboard or in contemporary Christian music magazine, the overwhelming majority of those people come from one of those three groups. So it's these three groups who are exercising a tremendous amount of influence over what we think of as evangelicalism. So it's not like generic evangelical. And through that music, people who were kind of, I guess, like the inverse of what you experienced, people who were in sort of, I think of them as normie evangelical world or conservative white Protestant world, like, you know, say you grew up in a conservative Presbyterian church or United Methodist church or something, all of a sudden you're getting this really dynamic, charismatic, Pentecostal cosmos, you know, like, and where did that come from? Well, it didn't come from the pulpit or from their denominational teachings. It came through music. It came through, like, you know, your experiences listening to DC Talk, who they are, the peak evangelical band comes from the very conservative Liberty University, which was founded by independent Baptists, but has a lot of strong ties to the Southern Baptist Convention as well. So these three groups of people are shaping and have shaped what it means to be quote unquote evangelical.
Are they still shaping music now? It seems like the Pentecostals, and it was later on my list, but it seems like Pentecostalism especially has really, and maybe more, we just are more aware of it, stepped into the space of contemporary Christian music and especially modern worship music. I mean, we go from Mav City to Hillsong to, you can name the list of people who are charismatic Pentecostal, much like the Vineyards of the 90s. Are these three tribes still the ones making impact, or is that kind of diversified more?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think that what we see in the rise of worship music is really the ascent of Pentecostals and charismatics. Like they waged and won the worship wars over time through music. Because everything that you just said, there's a little collective of people who study worship charts called worship research, I think is what they're called. And I'm sorry if I have that wrong. In fact, I should probably look it up, research, because I want to make sure that your people know who they are. Worshipleaderresearch.com. And they have analyzed the singing practices of churches who report their music through CCLI, which is a licensing, I know you know what that is, a licensing company that was born in a white charismatic congregation, but has pretty substantial influence over, they collect licensing fees from around the world, really. Anyway, so they have analyzed the types of music that people use in worship, and it's overwhelmingly produced by a very small group of charismatic megachurches. And so I think you can see the Pentecostal origins. I mean, charismatics, I like to think of them as sort of cousin slash sibling tradition. So you don't have to be in a Pentecostal denomination to act Pentecostally. And so those are the charismatics. You can be in almost any denomination, or no denomination at all. But those people are driving church music now. And so I think, you know, simultaneously the movements like the Southern Baptist Convention, which was at CCM's height, probably the single largest institution that upheld it in terms of they were interwoven into so many parachurch organizations that sponsored contemporary Christian music. For example, the True Love Waits organization, which started Abstinence, you know, that's a Southern Baptist org. Like they had so many affiliate organizations that were really the structure of contemporary Christian music. And that denomination is in precipitous decline right now. Mm-hmm. So and the holiness movements, the Nazarenes, the Wesleyan churches, they are also in decline. And so I think that the people who ascend through the market and through mass media are mostly these non-denominational charismatics. So there are some denominational folks every now and then, but you know, you mentioned, so some of the top producers of worship music, Bethel,
right,
Hillsong, Maverick City doesn't even have a church connected to Maverick City. Elevation Church, very recently disaffiliated from the Southern Baptist Convention. They were Southern Baptist in name only. You and I know, if you know anything about Elevation Church, like there's not a more Pentecostal church than a Pentecostal preacher than Stephen Furtick. But anyway, so those people are the dominant musical voices. And through that, they're shaping. I mean, I think something that Billy Graham understood really well was how music was a really big part of shaping the understandings of the Christian life. It's why he utilized music a lot. And so I think he was right about that, I think. Yeah. Not about everything, but he was right about that. And we're seeing that today. You know, you see those kinds of songs. And when I was a kid growing up in the 1990s, you would have never heard it. It would be an unusual thing to hear a charismatic worship song in a Baptist church. That would have been Baptists just going wild, Baptist gone wild, you know, like, but now
like a whole other book.
It's a whole other book. Yeah. I don't want to write that book. Somebody else is probably already writing it, but now it's hard to imagine a Baptist service without, you know, an elevation worship or a Hillsong song. So they have, their influence is profound. And I think sometimes it's hidden because maybe it's not institutional, you know, it's people will think, well, it's just the music. But if you experience that music, you know, it's, you could never say it's just the music, you know, like that's a really powerful thing in people's lives.
Has the shift in contemporary Christian music, and especially how radios are playing it, we now have complete worship radio stations where that was not the norm.
Right.
Has the fact that it's the accessibility of the of especially Pentecostal worship or Pentecostal Express worship is now radio friendly, made it more accessible for churches outside of those tribes to sing?
Yeah, I love that. That is a great question. Okay, so one of the funniest stories, I feel like as a Pentecostal, you will appreciate this in a way that people outside the charismatic and Pentecostal tradition can't really appreciate, which is that one of the reasons why that charismatic and Pentecostal music took a while to get on the radio was for very charismatic reasons. So I talked with a radio promoter and I asked him, what took Hillsong so long to chart? Because they weren't really, it was the 2010s when they really started making inroads on Christian radio, because I remember their music in the 1990s. So they were just tearing it up.
Shouts of the Lord 2000 was my CD. Like I wore that out.
Right. It was your jam, right? Yeah. So I knew that. And I talked with my friend, a scholar, Tanya Riches, who has done a lot of research into Australian Pentecostalism and Hillsong in particular. Mm-hmm. And she set me straight, because I said, well, no, they were way bigger before that, right? Before the 2010s. And she said, no, they did not crack that market. It took a while. And the reason why, when I talked to a Christian radio promoter, is he said, we couldn't get them to give us a song that was under like 12 minutes, you know?
Yeah, yeah. There was no radio edit, no radio
on the radio. Yeah, you have to, a radio edit can, 4 minutes is like the longest you'd ever want to do, you know, ideally like a 3.5 minute song. So what I trace in the book is how non-Pentecostals, non-charismatics appropriate the music and package it in a radio friendly way that gets it out to people. Yeah. So for example, David Crowder did a really good job. You know, he covered several more like Pentecostal charismatic-y songs. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes he would sort of clean them up a little bit. Like the most famous version of that is How He Loves,
which,
you know, memorable thing. But David Crowder was really big in the Passion Networks, which were in Southern Baptist, you know, like kind of Southern Baptist foundations and those neo-reformed circles. And so he introduced, you know, instead of Sloppy Wet Kiss, Unforeseen Kiss, which that whole lyric change has its own problems. But, you know, it was like, I think the idea is he like took the mysticism and the really like ecstatic, you know, ecstasy that charismatics and Pentecostals are here for every second of every day, clean, you know, made it more chaste. And then it was hugely successful. And but I would argue that really the best version of that song is listening to Kim Walker do it.
Oh my gosh, 100%.
For like 12 something minutes, and she's speaking in tongues halfway through. Yeah. And you know, I mean, it's just like, but that's the real experience of it from my perspective. I don't know what you think about
that. Oh, I love that version. Like if I've probably played that a million times. Now you know the Crowder story, right? Not about that song, but you know how Crowder got to start writing worship music.
I do.
He was at Baylor. I think with Louis Giglio and the whole Baylor young adult thing. And the story I've heard is that he was trying to prepare songs in his dorm room for a young adult service or something like that. And a non-Christian, I guess, floor mate comes in and goes, what are you doing? And he goes, I'm trying to write songs for, you know, this worship event. And the roommate or floor mate comes in and goes, I don't know what the explicative that is, but that's not it. And Crowder goes, then I have to write songs for this. And so that began sort of the David Crowder writing experience for writing songs for Passion. And like, I remember as a college student in the late 90s, Passion felt like it opened the door for this worship movement to kind of come in, especially with young adults. Like, it was like, now there's new music for us, you know?
Yeah, I read about the Passion trend as really baptizing charismatic and Pentecostal worship into Southern Baptist circles, because in part because of its roots at Baylor. And in those Southern Texas, the Passion movement introduced it to the Coalition of Christian Colleges and Universities crew, yeah. Right? Because it was a traveling worship experience. Like, it's basically a traveling revival service for these mostly conservative white Christian colleges. Mm-hmm. And some of whom were charismatic, and they knew, you of course know what they knew what to do when they were hearing songs from, especially people like charismatics, like Matt Redman, you know, like, yeah. they'd be like, oh, I know what this is. Salvation spring up from the ground. I'm going to, you know, but it also appealed. And I think it introduced charismatic worship styles into young adult communities that wouldn't have necessarily been raised with that. And so of course you can see the appeal. It is stadium rock worship. And what's interesting is that stadium rock as rock, by that time, white dominant form of music, was declining on top 40 radio. Mm-hmm. It was ascending in these revivalist spaces. And I just find that to be fascinating. So like the top 40 was getting more diverse and rock was less and less on the charts. And then it finds a place to thrive in these stadium rock settings, to the point where now guitars are, I can't remember if it's Taylor. I found like that. I'll have to look it up here. I think it might be Taylor guitars or probably. What's another one.
Gibson or Martin.
It could be Martin. They are like, churches are some of the top selling or top customers for guitars now. So like that music, like it has found a home in these, like that kind of stadium rock sound, has found a home there.
Like,
so
as a late 90s college student, like, you had to bring your acoustic guitar to campus with you. Like, everybody had one. Like, if you were a youth pastor, you had to learn to play. Like, I failed epically at learning to play guitar. Like, I don't name drop, but the Grammy award winning guy who tried to teach me, or is now a Grammy award winner, he was like, Jeff, you should probably quit. Like, and obviously he's gone on to know what he was talking about, because has like two Grammys. Funny. Not in Christian music. God. Like, maybe one in Christian music. I mean, he's got a Dove award, I think, but yeah.
Oh my gosh, that is so funny. Fender. That's who it was. Okay. Sorry. Look. That is really funny. I do remember that. I remember there was a time when, you know, if they weren't, they would probably play some sort of praise and worship song and then like go into like More Than Words.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if they were trying to really like get a date or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. That didn't work out for you. The guitars. That wasn't going to be the way it was going
to
happen.
I would be broke in Nashville, still trying to make it if I could play. That would be the problem. I would have been at your Starbucks trying to hit up and get free coffee or something. You mentioned something about stadium rock and sort of the rise and the ascend in Christian music and the drop in top 40. And this is just personal sort of assessment, but it always feels like the art form of Christian music is 2 to 3 years behind pop culture.
Yes.
Is my read on that right? Or is that just me being critical?
No, that's 100% right. And one of the things that I tried to show in the book is that that is by design. So I think I try really hard not to be cynical at all when I wrote this. And I should say that, you know, I grew up in charismatic spaces with praise and worship music, but my dad didn't like contemporary Christian music. So I didn't grow up in a home where it was used as a parenting tool the way a lot of people do. So But I, of course, understood its reputation as such. And that's one of the things that I try to really get at in the book, which is, how did that happen? Why was that the case? You know, why was this form of pop music with kind of evangelical spins on Christian, on pop music, why was that seen as a form of parenting? So the book really explores that. But also, if you're going to say to yourself, and many, many evangelical parents and caregivers, youth pastors, music ministers, et cetera, came to see pop music, Christian pop music, as a way to keep their children safe, as a way to keep them inside the walls of the church, and as a way to help them become healthy and thriving adolescents and then adults who would someday raise children of their own the same way, you know, repeat. Why did they see that? That's something I explore in the book. But because they did that, it necessarily, it meant that lagging behind pop culture was a part of the project.
Really?
So if the idea is you want to create, you know, say in the 1980s, you're frustrated that your children are listening to Madonna or, you know, Kiss or something like that, Prince. So what do? You know, you create quote unquote safe alternatives. And they were marketed as such. If you grew up in that world, you remember the infamous charts, the comparison charts, where
I
would, it's like,
I had them as a youth pastor.
Love
if
it.
If you like yep. this, okay, so listen to this.
Is the most genius marketing tool from contemporary Christian music industry people. But so, yeah. So if you're going to have a chart, you know, where you compare the things, you're never going to be an artistic leader, you know, because you're always responding in some sort of way. It's like, okay, what do the kids want? We've got to create what the kids want. And, you know, in the book I talk about, it had limited success. I mean, there was a lot of reasons why most people grew out of it. So the book explores how adolescence and like how popular music came to be fused with the American imagination around teendom and adolescence, and how the effort to create non-transgressive pop music was always going to fail, because the whole appeal of pop music includes transgression. So you're supposed to be in some way rebelling against your parents, like doing something a little out of bounds in the whole project of pop music. And so creating safe alternatives doesn't really last forever, because usually what happens is young people would get to the age where they could manage their own media and choose in some way. I mean, there's so many stories, funny stories that I include in the book where young people hide it from their parents. They like sneak. No, I mean, did you do that? Were you immediate?
So I was not. I mean, again, I think we're a similar age or around the similar time frame.
Yeah.
I remember I had to go to a friend's house to watch MTV's Top 10 Video Countdown, which at the time, early 80s, had Striper on it. But they were going to hell because they were on MTV and they wore spandex, right? I mean, like, so what do we do with the outliers who kind of cracked into culture without being lagging behind? I mean, I think at the time, early on, DC Talk would have been that, like this sort of hybrid pop rap thing that they were, it wasn't quite culturally cool. There was like In Living Color and a couple of bands ahead of them in pop culture that were doing it, but it seemed edgy in the Christian marketplace. But like Striper was in the throes of glam rock, right? They weren't 3 years behind.
Yeah, that's right. I would say I would put DC Talk firmly in the lag behind category.
Okay.
In terms of, you know, however we want to categorize them. If we want to say in the earlier days, they kind of had more hip hop rap, that would have been much later. It's after rap ascends in the, on the pop culture or pop and hip hop and R&B charts. And I think that probably their biggest album culturally would have to be Jesus Freak.
It's still my favorite album.
Okay. Yeah. And so that was released 4 years after grunge came around. Mm-hmm. And so, and it sounds, this is so funny because my, my research assistant, Austin, I have to always give him a shout out here. He had only heard Jesus Freak, had never heard Smells Like Teen Spirit from Nirvana. And I said, well, you know, they're essentially the same chords. And so then I played him. You can find this mashup on YouTube where it's the songs, they're on top of each other. And sure enough, and it was this funniest conversation. He was like mind blown, like, oh my gosh, because Jesus Freak was his Smells Like Teen Spirit. It was like a fun intergenerational conversation too. Anyway, so DC Talk, I look at them as like, yeah, they're the peak of the model. They executed it so well and created really good facsimiles. You know, like it's not that it was bad music at all. It was really well executed, but it did lag behind. I think Stryper, one of the things that I look at is why Stryper did not have staying power in contemporary Christian music, but Petra did. So they're contemporaries. Yeah. And I think everything that you just said is part of it. They were a glam band with like full face of makeup, you know, deep, like V-neck, very deep V-neck.
I don't know if you call it V-neck. There was no neck left.
It's just like their chests, their bare chests. Yeah. Like they were sex, you know, they were using sex appeal the same way that other glam bands were doing at the time.
And they were like touring with regular rock bands.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so that was just like by, you know, there were going to be so many, I think especially the gender bendy stuff, you know, that was just not going to be sustainable in a movement that at the time was really gearing up a lot of, you know, there had been a lot of social change in the 1980s. And so there were organizations like the Dobson Organization, Focus on the Family, who really came to see gender confusion as a big social theological problem. So they were really like stepping up efforts to enforce traditional distinctions between women and men. And then you have this band of rockers who they have big hair and makeup, you know, tight little spandex outfits. And then you have Petra, where they're, for lack of a better word, they're like dudes in t-shirts, you know? They're very traditionally masculine. They're wearing t-shirts and jeans. But more than that, they never sought that mainstream audience that Stryper had. They were really excited about being a youth group band. So they would create Bible studies where they would you know, partner with youth organizations. You know, maybe you saw some, but they had, you know, if they had a new album come out, they would do like a discussion questions and a booklet and aids for youth groups in a way that Stryper never did. And so I think that's why, you know, the groups that could hang in the mainstream world and who wanted to, it was like a different skill set to succeed over time in contemporary Christian music and a different really like philosophy of art, you know, what is all of this for? And so for groups like Petra, it's for serving church groups. Yeah. It's for making them, you know, exposing them to Christian scripture and Christian teaching. And the music is very secondary. You know, and that's why a lot of time, you know, Petra had a lot of different sounds over the years. And that's because the sound really wasn't the thing, you know, it was, how are we, I mean, they produced some really incredible stuff. The whole, my book, the title of my book is a Petra cover of an Argent song. Right. So
which was a Kiss Kiss covered as well.
Covered as well. Yep. My two little guys like the Kiss version the best.
That's the best version. I shouldn't say that on air, but yeah, it's a pretty good version.
You know what? The Petra version is super solid. I highly recommend it.
It's good too. I know. I had to Beat the System on cassette.
You did? Okay. Yeah. All right. So yeah, that I think that those groups, like the ones who, this was just a constant source of tension because there are people who wanted to succeed in the mainstream and were very frustrated, especially by the late 1990s, early 2000s. There was a whole cohort of groups who did not want to be labeled quote unquote Christian. And it was very frustrating for them. Some of them actually even filed lawsuits, like because they didn't want to be marketed as such. For the ones who attained mainstream success, a lot of times it's just like it's a different set of needs. It's a different market niche, really.
So my favorite band right now, and right now by the last decade, really, I'm going to confess that.
Yeah.
Falls in that category of not wanting to be a Christian band. Need to breathe.
Oh, right.
Bear Reiner has been very outspoken. They're like Bear and his brother Bo are AG kids, but they've been very outspoken about not being a Christian band, but a band of Christians.
Right.
And I feel like that's sort of the pushback on the ones who want to really be an artist. Like, they want their art taken seriously. They don't want to be part of this sort of boxed and packaged deal called Christian music, which is going to change 3 years from now based on what pop music is. And there's no space for the artist. Is there going to be more of that and people who are kind of toes in both worlds of Christian music and secular music, as the lines seem a lot more blurry than they once were, at least with the access to music digitally?
Yeah. One of the things that I describe in the book is what I think of as the fall of contemporary Christian music. So the idea, you know, at its height, contemporary Christian music, it existed alongside really the pinnacle of Billy Graham evangelicalism. You know, like the idea that there's this predominantly white network of conservative Protestant groups that cooperate together. They do lots of different kinds of ministries together, especially aimed at young people, Campus Crusade for Christ and Inner Varsity and all these. And then they're all their denominational things and youth groups and all of that. Really, that made contemporary Christian music into what it became, which was around a $1 billion industry. It was hugely profitable at its height. But all of those things that I just listed, including things like Christian music festivals, are in decline now. Mm-hmm. So some of that has to do with, there's like a million reasons. It would take too long to talk about them here. But one of them has to do with the reason or the way that people consume music. So if, for example, you're a 15-year-old kid and you're being raised in an, you know, quote unquote evangelical church, say the Willow Creek type of church, you can curate music for yourself. First of all, the internet did a ton to undermine CCM because contemporary Christian music was really funded by moms, like the bookstore moms. And moms lost so much power over governing their kids' media intake when the internet came along, because things like file sharing happened and then streaming. And then, so now young kids can create their own Spotify lists and they might like a worship song here and there. Many do, but then they just want a regular mainstream artist as well. So you can't, like, the bubble of it has burst. And there will always be versions. Like, I think a lot of people would point to Lauren Daigle as an example of kind of an old style, like that she, I think like her, at least her people have mainstream aspirations for her, but really her bread and butter audience is church people who want a sound that's not very far off from Adele, but has, you know, evangelical themes that go into it. So there'll always be people like that. But I think the need to breathe people, I have to say that people like that, I came to feel a lot of empathy for, because most of them, when they were put into that category of Christian band, were very, very young, who I wouldn't expect them at that time to have been super aware of the institutional things that were like feeding the industry and going into creating the mechanisms of the business. And I wouldn't expect, you know, I don't know how old the Need to Breathe guys were when they first got started, but I wouldn't expect someone in their late teens, early 20s to be aware of any of that stuff. Right. Like, and so before they could even really make a choice about how they were going to be presented to the world, they were already presented to the world in a particular frame. So, I mean, some of them grew to like publicly chafe against that. Like, I do not want that identity. Like, that is not me. And there were some people who I thought were very cynical, you know, saying like, oh, you used these networks when they did you some good, but now you're, yeah. you know, you're, and that is a complete misunderstanding of how that industry works. First off, the idea that they, that people like me, that they could make more money in the general market is laughable. Because a lot of the money actually was in those kind of, you know, evangelical church right. spaces. They were probably, if I had to guess, they were giving up profits to exist outside of that. And then also, I think it's very cynical to think that people, like that they were using those networks in a way, if they say that they're not. So anyway, I came to appreciate. Because, you know, no one was following me around when I was 18 years old and asking me to serve as a moral exemplar and a representative of evangelical norms for everyone right. to consume. Yeah. No one was doing that to me.
Yeah.
And I feel lucky because I talked to a lot of people who were raised and who really came of age as contemporary Christian music artists. And that was their life. And that is a hard life. So anyway, that's my soapbox there. I feel for folks because I don't know. Aren't you glad that there's no record of your? I mean,
oh my Lord! if there was social media when I was in college, like it would have been disastrous. Like good and bad and indifferent. Like and I would. I mean, the fact that there's photographs of the haircuts I had are bad enough. Like
right?
if they lived right. on in infamy for everybody to see, that would be just a terrible thing. Like I had the bleach blonde tips at one point. It was a bad deal. Oh, like gosh, nobody should it. See that photo. So
did you have like the Greek thing where, you know, or like the
Clooney Roman? Haircut? Yeah. Yeah. The Clooney. I rocked that for a long time. Yeah. Oh, if it was popular in the 90s and early 2000s, I probably did it. Like I'm shamefully love right. it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Base history tends to repeat itself. We know that. Mm-hmm. And you're a historian. So as a historian, and looking, if you can look 5 years ahead to Christian music, where is music going? Are we going to stay in this pocket of worship music? Will it shift again?
That's a great question. Okay, I think in terms of history repeating itself, one thing that I recorded again and again was how technology and the marketplace made unexpected interventions along the way. So there's one thing that I know will happen is that there will be tech interventions and major unexpected social movements that, and there will be business changes that accompany those, probably interwoven in all of that, that will shift things. What that will look like in the future, I'm not sure, but I know for sure that will happen. I think one of the best examples of that would have been the kind of the, all of those things coming together would have been the COVID-19 pandemic. Nobody saw that coming. But one of the things that it did, especially in the lives of evangelical consumers, is that it completely shifted how people did worship and music in church. And I remember when it happened, I was teaching, like when, as the lockdowns were rolling out, I was teaching a class that had a Zoom component. And I asked my students, you know, pay attention to who will ascend in this time. Like there are always surprising actors that kind of benefit from these terrible circumstances. And from that, we saw the ascent of groups like Elevation Church and Maverick City, because they had created these really stirring musical experiences that people all over the world
yeah.
found comfort in during the pandemic. And so there, I know for sure that things like that will happen. If I had to guess, the decline of institutions in the United States is not going to go anywhere. I think that will continue. Mm-hmm. And the use and the use of media and the marketplace among charismatics is also not going to go anywhere. So I would expect probably more of that, with the caveat that things can always change. And yeah. if the past is any predictor, we just don't know what's coming. And yeah. and there could be some major technological development that completely upends everything that I've been talking about. And I kind of find that to be interesting.
How much, yeah, and how much, we talked about Azusa Street, you talked about coming yeah. from the Jesus movement of the 70s. Both those movements sparked new music. How much could a third possible revival in America do that again?
Oh, the great thing about Americans is that they are constantly reviving themselves. It is an old tale. Before there was a United States, there were revivals and revivalists. So it is happening. I guarantee it, it has and it will happen. There was one, moment not too long ago at Asbury, which I thought was wonderful.
Literally talked to Zach Mirkibs this morning.
Oh, that's great. Okay, so I think of that as that brought so many things together because the Asbury was a Jesus music hub in the mm-hmm. in the 1970s, and so, but more importantly, it is a holiness revival style place, right? So the Asbury, I think the Asbury revival or outpouring, they are calling it, I think outpouring, mm-hmm. but I think that's an excellent example of revivalism as a practice. I don't necessarily. I'm a historian. I can't really evaluate, was God doing something in this space? That's not the tool set that I bring. I believe right. God moves in the world. So, but what I can tell you is that revivalists know how to revive. So those people, the young people who were doing that, they are inheritors of a much longer tradition. Like there's a reason why there are all of a sudden grandparents showing up for that. They knew exactly what was up. They might not have known those songs, but they knew how some of them, they did sing a lot of old songs. They knew how to be. So I think it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And I think, for me as a historian, I'm always curious to see what are the conditions that create specific styles of revival, because the Azusa Street revival meeting was very distinct in so many ways. A lot of times people want to look at the tongues, speaking in tongues, or the mystical experiences, but the revivalists at the time were really focusing on the interracial qualities of that revival meeting. So I'm always curious, what do those revival meetings say about the people who are practicing and how God is moving among them? So it'll happen. It is happening right now.
Yeah, it is. It is. I believe that. I could talk all day about this, but you have probably things to do. So I've got one final question that I ask all my guests, since the show is titled The Collective's Conversations. Who is one person, historical, present, fictional, or in your real life that you want to sit down and have a conversation with?
Oh, for me, that's an easy one. My first book was about Amy Semple McPherson, who is the founder of the Foursquare mm-hmm. Church, died long time before I was born. I always am in conversation with her. I believe in the communion of the saints. So I'm always thinking about her and I would love to talk with her. She'd be high on my list.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for your time. Thank you for your research. Thank you for nerdy people like me who love Christian music and have loved it since we were kids. The book is what I've been able to read is fascinating. I'm excited to finish it. And just as we always say here at the Collective's Conversation, you got a seat at the table. Thank you, Dr. Payne.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Wow. What a great conversation that was. Thanks for joining us in the conversation. If something from the conversation really stood out to you, would you share it and tag me on social media at Jeff_Pitts_ on Instagram? And we would love it if you would rate and review and subscribe to the show. That just helps us reach more people with these great conversations. And as we always say, you've got a seat at the table. Thanks for joining the conversation.